It ain't that simple, mate.
Hello and welcome to It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast, where we talk about poverty and missions and all things related to those subjects. I'm Fraser Scott, here with Kevin Honoré. Hey, Kev.
Yeah, g'day, Fraser. How you doing, man?
I'm doing about the same as you. I think we're both sitting here suspecting we have COVID and wondering how many of these podcasts we have in us.
Well, maybe we should get them to move back from the computer a little.
Yeah. Don't get too close.
Don't get too close.
That's right. Use speakers rather than headphones. And speaking of COVID, we are, of course, in season 3 of our podcast, and we are looking at kind of a reflection, having come through the COVID years, as we are now officially calling them. And we're looking at the kind of partnerships that Bright Hope World's involved in, and particularly looking at some of the challenges that the world is facing at the moment, some of the different trends and movements. And so on our last episode, we were looking at humanitarian and relief partnerships. We talked about the rise in refugees as well, which was a part of that. And so today we are looking at orphans and vulnerable children, which is another area, one of our 6 areas where Bright Hope World has partnerships. And this is one that's pretty close to our hearts. It certainly, it's pretty hard to travel and see where orphans and vulnerable children are struggling. So this is something that we give a lot of attention to. Kev, is that appropriate? I mean, orphans are mentioned a lot in the scriptures particularly. Is it appropriate that we would have a particular focus in this area?
Oh, yeah, absolutely it is. I mean, kids have always been on God's heart. He's always had a soft spot for them, so to speak. I think it's just unquestionable, our involvement. You couldn't not be involved in this if you're involved in development. It's on God's heart. And then from their human point of view, they are the most vulnerable people in the world.
Yeah.
And what's more vulnerable than a little kid that's malnourished or lost its... a picture came to mind from a video we just saw from one of our partners after the earthquake in Syria, where she tells a story of, you know, they went into this place and here was this little 4-year-old sitting on top of what was their house with her brother buried underneath, you know, just sobbing her heart out. And she didn't know where her parents were. As it turned out, they had survived. Her brother was in hospital, but she was just, how could you not do something, you know? How could you not care? And I think God's always, like I said, had a soft heart for kids.
And it's, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that one can take for granted, where we place a really high value on kids, which was not always the case, you know, even going back 100 years or 200 years ago.
Oh, wow, absolutely.
And it's not the case everywhere. I mean, I think, you know, if you were to talk to anyone within the Bright Hope World team, everyone has those stories of those kids that touched their hearts. For me, you know, we have a partner in India, and he adopted a little girl that was just thrown onto a rubbish heap for no other reason than that she had the misfortune to be born a girl. And a dog attacked her. She lost
her
eye. And
I was looking at a photo of her just a couple of days ago.
And she's beautiful. And you know, and now she works in the ministry. She looks after the kids, and it's just an absolute delight. And so you see that practical in action. But let's sort of get a bit more granular on
There's one more thing in there, Fraser, too, is that historically the church has really valued children highly.
It has.
Yeah, it's got involved, and the Christian message has significantly changed whole cultures' attitudes towards kids.
I think about, you know, that story. I read a great book about this, where when the church was really just first establishing itself in the Roman world, and, you know, in that world where a child was unwanted, they would just go put the child on the city walls to die of exposure, but the Christians would sneak out at night and take these kids into their homes. And that, along with, you know, the response of the church to the plagues, were two of the biggest factors in the reputation of the church being established, is to say we will not let this go unchallenged, unresponded to. It's fantastically important.
Yeah, and I think it's a real challenge for us in the West as well, the way our Western cultures are currently moving in regard to children, especially the unborn children, you know, where they're just treated as a commodity, as something to be, attitude towards it. They're not an inconvenient commodity. That every one of them, right from conception, is a unique creation made in the likeness of image of God, and I think that's what we haven't done it very well necessarily, the church, but that's what we bring to the table in regard to kids, is this high value on every person that's conceived. I was just talking to one of our facilitators recently, and they've just had a baby with Down syndrome, and the trauma that they went through as the medical profession tried to suggest that they should abort this child because it wasn't going to be perfect from their perspective. And they just said, this is the way it is, so we'll carry on with this. And then, you know, there'll be implications for that, but that's the heart of God. And when we look out on the world, if we don't see the kids and we don't see those that are these vulnerable ones, and we don't do something about it, it's an indictment on us, frankly.
Let's look at vulnerable children, who they are, where they are, some of the issues and the realities they have to deal with. Just let's talk firstly about where do we find orphans and vulnerable children?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we talk about where our partners live, and they live in the margins. Our partners are working with people who, I guess you could say, suffer from general poverty. I mean, there are specific aspects of poverty, but general poverty, it kind of just robs kids of their childhood. They don't get to grow up. They don't get to play. They don't get to...
And they're often sent out to work, right?
I mean, really young. Right? Yeah. Four or five. As soon as they can stand,
that's their
and
value.
Hold something. Yeah. That's... So general poverty and intergenerational poverty diminishes the value of kids as well. So in many cases, and we'll come to this again when we talk about specific poverty, but, you know, they start to demean those who are deemed to have less value because they can't work, disabled kids, females in some societies, as you mentioned before. So yeah, general poverty just places a lot of pressure on kids growing up with any kind of normal lifestyle, and that shapes the rest of their lives.
I mean, you mentioned kids with disabilities, and I just visited a partner in Jordan that is focused on, you know, kids that are very poor situations, but where as a result of particularly culture, these kids are a source of huge shame to the family. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's true that wherever poverty impacts people, it impacts, I guess, women more intensely and children more intensely again. Yeah. And then I suppose if you're a child with disabilities, you're really hit hard.
Yeah, well, a disabled child is probably about as bad as it can get in many places, where in poor communities, because this becomes such a drain on society. And hence, in many pagan animistic cultures, why they were tossed out to be, you know, eaten by the animals or
as we're seeing with this partnership, it's a curse. Your family is starting to look, what did we do to bring this curse upon us? So imagine, you know, living with the mantle of being the manifestation of a curse. Mm-hmm. It's just horrific.
Yeah, it is. And especially moving where you see partners that have a specific focus on disabled. I'm just thinking of the guys in Zambia. We were talking about them earlier today, where with Sarah there, she's got 52 like deaf kids that she's looking after, you know? It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Something very special about that.
Yeah, I mean, because again, looking after children of any kind, yeah. that's tough. But where you've got that extra layer, it's an extraordinary calling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, of course, there's some places where, and you often see this on TV, where hunger or famine comes in, and you can see how it stunts their development, and how you know, you can imagine that little bag of bones that's on the TV there. What has that done to that little kid in terms of their lifespan, their life expectancy, their quality of life from now on, their ability to learn?
It's one of the things we were talking about this earlier, where, you know, I remember as a kid, famines in Ethiopia, and you're seeing, you know, these poor little kids with distended bellies and flies around their eyes. And you see that once or twice. And then there is something that kicks in the Western mind, and I hope I'm not generalizing unfairly here, where you sort of disengage, you detach a little bit, and you imagine, well, they're used to that. You know, their experience of it is not like my experience of it would be. But then when you go and you meet and you talk to these kids, that is not true. Sorry, folks, that is not true. Their experience of it is exactly like your experience of it would be.
Yeah,
so, definitely. You know, you put your own child in that situation, that is what it is like.
Yeah, very much so. And there's some places you go where they have this kwashiorkor, which, you know, you see it in the kids. Their hair is discolored. It should be black, but it's kind of orangey brown. And they're not hungry right now, but hunger in the past has
had a permanent effect on them.
Yeah, an ongoing effect on them. It's tough. And the other thing it does too, and you see it in some places, just when you go into schools in these really poverty-stricken areas, and you'll see the kids all there, and they don't have the ability to learn very much.
Because they're hungry.
They're hungry, their minds have been affected by poverty, by hunger and lack of nourishment as a youngster, and so they're permanently disabled because of maybe a year long or 18 month long drought or something when they were a 2 year old or a 3 year old or something like that, and they just then a whole cohort of kids is messed up in that community. It's not an easy one. And I think, you know, with these types of things we're talking about, we don't want to be talking about statistics, because it's not about statistics. It's about that bunch of little kids there who have been messed up, their whole lives messed up because there was an event, a hunger event or a famine or something in their lives, and they'll spend the rest of their lives dealing with the outflow or the outcome of that. So.
Well, I mean, you know, when one realises the magnitude of the problem, it is easy to get overwhelmed by it. But then, you know, when you sit talking to that little kid, it's like, well, I'll just, you know, it's the starfish principle, isn't it? It's like, well, I help this one.
Help this one, yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that is an issue. You can't help them all. And it goes back a little bit to that, the previous one we were talking about, Fraser, with that whole how do you respond in these cases? It's very easy to be very emotive and, you know, respond from an emotional point of view. And it's very easy for organisations to manipulate Western responses by using...
Particularly with kids.
With kids, especially, you know, hungry kids with, you know, big eyes and flies and...
Mm.
And all that, and there's some serious responsibility around how that's portrayed, because that is a real person, and in the long run, emotive responses are still not a strategic way to deal with that issue.
No, I'm going to make a statement here, because we talked in our previous podcast.
Please, folks, if you have any complaints,
I mean, you know, I get asked a lot. You know, how should I decide which organisation to donate to?
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you asking me that? It's Bright Eye World. Why are we talking any further? But assuming that there are some needs out there that we don't meet, one of the things I do say is, you if you are being exposed to that kind of subtly manipulative look at this poor child, that to me is it's a bit of a red flag.
Absolutely.
I don't like that.
No, and it's so easy to do. It's a cheap form of marketing, frankly. And it's not just from the big organisations. It's about being responsible in the whole. When you're in the presence of poverty, is how do you respond to it? Do you pull your camera out and take that photo, or do you not? And we would say most cases not. You step away, or you step towards that person and you help. You're not there as a journalist or a reporter. You're there as a representative of the king, and I'm sure, you know. Well, you know, Jesus didn't have cameras, but he wouldn't have been out there with his. He would have stepped into their circumstances and done something strategic that changed the course of their lives. So that's, kids, it's a real hard one, this whole kids area.
Let's talk about some of the other issues. Yeah.
Child mortality. It's a shocker. I mean, because they're the most vulnerable, then when pressure comes on from poverty,
they're
the first ones that go down. It's always been this way. And part of the reason why we need to think strategically, because just addressing the symptoms of the poverty doesn't stop this happening. That's why development is such an important part of the whole thing, and why we are so passionate about developing is how do you empower families and communities so there's some resilience when poverty is a big issue, whether that's an event based poverty or where they live. How do you engage with this the systemic issue that's causing that problem?
Well, we mentioned, kids being forced, being required to work. I guess there are those sort of ancillary issues. You know, we did some water projects where the kids are sent to get the water, the stream gets up, kids get washed away.
Yeah.
Or where, you've got unsafe working conditions, it's the kids that go to work in them, and then the kids get killed or they get sick because of it. I mean, again, there's just an inherent vulnerability, isn't there? That whatever the situation is, it's going to be worse for them.
Yeah, totally. And especially when there's very little resource that the parents have or the community has to change their circumstances, or they get trapped into a lifestyle where they can't see a way out of it. It's like, for example, we were in a brick kiln in Pakistan a few weeks ago, and we were talking to this family. They've got two kids at a little school there, and they're bonded labourers. And how long you been here? Oh, 20 years ago. 20 years. Oh, well, you don't look like you're that old. He said, I inherited the debt of my father, and so he's now second generation. That kid in the school's third generation. And so we're talking with our friends there, how do you deal with this thing? And he says, well, some people come along and they pay the debt, and they do that. But then
you're feeding the system.
Well, these people then don't have any skills. So what do they do now? They just bond themselves to another place up the road, and they might have slightly better conditions or whatever, and go back into, because they haven't got anything. They haven't got anything other options for themselves, and this is the life they know, and they don't want to be doing nothing all the rest of their life.
Well, you think of the cultural expectations. I mean, we have an idea of what a child should be doing, and what childhood looks like, and then you go to places where girls are getting married at 12, 13, 11. How do we as Westerners grapple with that? Do we step in and say, no, that's not okay, or are we being Western in that space? I mean, these are real-life challenges.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not that simple, mate.
It's not that simple,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah, but talking about that one, we talked about disabled children as being very vulnerable, and in many cultures, girls are probably the next, girl children are the next vulnerable group, because they are a burden on the family, so they'll they'll marry them off as soon as they can to ease the burden and maybe get some money as well. But it's extremely difficult when that's the whole culture, like in southern Madagascar. You know, with the girls there, just treated like animals. In fact, the cows have birth certificates, but the girls don't. And we were in one place where a man hadn't paid the dowry to his parents-in-law.
And I just want to pause, just in case anyone missed that. The cows have birth certificates,
yeah.
But the girls don't.
But the girls don't.
Just sit with that for a moment. That's the reality.
Yeah, it is the reality. And if you don't like the girl that you got the last sale, you just take her back down and trade her in for a cow or another girl or whatever.
Boy.
And so we were talking to this guy and his wife who'd become believers and were just outstanding. You could tell from their faces that there was something different about these people. And they were in tears when we were there because he hadn't had the money, didn't have the money to have paid the dowry for his wife. And so his parents-in-law now had come to him and said, well, we'll take your oldest daughter. She'd turned 12. And so they said, well, how come? Well, you haven't paid, so we'll take her and sell her off, and that'll be the payment for your dowry, $250. So that's the value of a girl there, $250. The value for a cow, $500.
Boy.
So, yeah, that's the reality for these kids. So can you not do something?
It's where I suppose, I mean, you know, I know our partners have, you know, share the same Christian values, and I know they push back on those cultural issues, which is a heck of a lot easier than us pushing back on them. But you realise that when you step into this space, you step into a minefield.
Oh,
You know, it's heartbreaking, and then you emotionally respond to it, and you can really get yourself in trouble in this space.
Yeah, you can. And she was struggling. Our partner there was struggling because she comes from another part of the country. Mm. And so even she was an outsider. So she was as much an outsider as we were in struggling with all of this and how to deal with it. And so a lot of the people in her, the network that she's developing are young people. And so, because they're running into trouble too because they're young and they don't have the authority to make change or affect the way, you know, the culture's thinking, but they've just got to do something. It's they're dealing with some pretty hefty issues in that case. And then you go into issues like, you know, child soldiers and war and internal conflict and
sex trafficking.
I mean, it's just such big issues for vulnerable kids, and that's, you know, all of those things are part of what our partners are dealing with.
Let's pause there. We will take a little break and we'll come back and talk about, I mean, you know, you start to scratch the surface and you see how big the problem is. What we want to do is explore some of the responses that maybe aren't what we would consider ideal, and then some of the things that we're doing that we think really do make an impact on that. So we will be right back. You are on It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast. It Ain't That Simple, Mate is brought to you by Lamai Coffee. Lamai Coffee is the finest quality organic Arabica coffee from the northern hills of Thailand. We at Bright Hope World import the green beans into New Zealand and we roast them to perfection, then sell them to discerning coffee drinkers. We're all volunteers on the team, so all the profits go back into great community projects in Thailand. And that is why we call it the world's best tasting act of kindness. You can order Lamai Coffee or find out more at lamai.co.nz.
It ain't that simple, mate.
Welcome back. You are listening to It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast. And today we're talking about another of Bright Hope World's category of partnerships. We are looking at orphans and vulnerable children partnerships, the sort of works that we do where orphans and vulnerable children are a focus. And in the first half of the podcast, we looked at some of the realities and challenges and complexities of this whole space and some of the just terrible and heartbreaking things that kids in the majority world have to face in certain contexts. And so now we want to shift a little bit, and we want to look at how one can respond. Some of the different things that one can do to try and help these kids. And we want to talk about a couple of common ones, and then some of the things that we're kind of exploring and seeing work pretty well. So, Kiva, anyone that has engaged with Bright Hope World will know that we have expressed at various times opinions. We've expressed many opinions about many things. We're very opinionated. But
speak for yourself, Fraser.
Well, I do. I'm speaking for you as well because I'm opinionated. We've expressed some views about some of the challenges between two responses here. One being orphanages in the traditional sense, and another being child sponsorship programs. Now, again, before we wade into this, let's just say it is complicated. It's not simple. And there are wonderful people in both of these spaces doing great things. But let's have a look at some of these things and maybe stimulate some thinking here. Let's start with orphanages. What's the problem? I mean, one, when we talk about traditional orphanages, what do they look like? What are we describing here?
Yeah, well, you're grabbing a bunch of kids that are already traumatized, fearful, despairing, and you're putting them together in a often in an environment that's quite different to what they're used to. They might be used to a village environment or a tribal environment, just their tribe or their family, and so you're banging them in with a bunch of other kids, usually quite large numbers, and that's a recipe for all sorts of, it's just fraught with difficulty for the kids. And unless there's extremely good processing of those kids, to help them deal with the baggage they bring to the table, you're adding more layers of complexity on their lives. Shift them from a rural environment to an urban environment. There's so many factors in that.
And that they're expensive, aren't they? I mean, that's one of the realities. I know it's not all about money, but it's a little bit about money.
Yeah.
Orphanages tend to be very expensive to develop, particularly if you're looking to build nice buildings and provide a great environment for these kids. That's expensive.
Yep.
They're expensive to run. And one wonders how you get on when Western donors like us tend to be quite,
short attention span.
Yeah, we're not into the things that take decades, as we know, necessarily. There must be quite a challenge for those trying to do this sort of thing.
Well, it's interesting, you travel around and you see orphanages, and many of them were set up like in the middle of the 20th century, so they're 50, 60, 70 years old. And the conditions, the maintenance on the buildings is run down, the sick situation that they're in. And you've just got to think about, well, what does this look like in 5 years from now? It might look nice when you've got 20 kids, running around, playing in the field, jumping around, kicking a football. But what does it look like if 30, 40, 50 years? Because it is a long-term thing you're doing here. And often we don't think through the long-term implications. What happens when the founder dies? Might have been a fantastic person or couple or lady. But what's the next generation? Are you setting up another whole generation of kids that are going to be exposed to some kind of, person who shouldn't be in leadership of an institution like that?
Well, you think about it as well. I mean, even with Bright Hope World, right? So, who knows in 20 years' time if we're still around, and maybe the people around then, maybe they don't care about it quite as much as we do, and then the standard of care, it's not someone's driving passion, maybe it's just a job. And then what happens to the kids?
Well, the second generation of leadership, often it does become just a job, or they're not visionaries, they become just managers. And so the amount of money then doesn't, because it has to increase every year, so they end up managing a diminishing pool of funds. And so the conditions for the kids get worse and worse and worse. And that's the story we see all over the world. Because, you know, orphanages are a Western concept, to be fair. It's not what traditionally would happen in Africa. Somehow those kids would be cared for in the context of the extended family or the community. And again, you know, great orphanages are out there. So we're not criticising any specific one, but in general we're saying not a flash idea, frankly.
Well, I mean, I guess even with the great orphanages, especially with the great orphanages, you run the risk then of you're providing a level of care for children, particularly in a you know, economically depressed area, where the kids are actually cared for better than they're cared for in the surrounding area. So then what happens?
Well, yeah, we often run into the orphan elite.
Yeah.
And so the kids, the families are then creating orphans.
Yeah, they abandon kids they go to the orphanage, they get cared for better. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but it happens.
We had a funny situation in Ethiopia where we'd been there and we were working with some folks there, and one year we went there into the city, and there was a group of people from a Western country there playing games in the field with the kids. There was a big team of them, and they were doing the stuff, and so we kind of went and wandered over and found out what was going on, and we got the card of one of the leaders of it, and I went on, you know, I didn't communicate with them, but I started just looking at what they're doing online and all that kind of stuff. And over the next two or three years, watched how, you know, this program that they'd be doing was fantastic. And so all these orphans came out onto the street, all these street kids came out, and they had like 50 or 60 of these kids. And then they started a feeding program, and now it had grown to 200 kids. This was over a period of like a couple of 3 years. We went back, saw our people there, and a lot of these people were church planting out in the rural areas around the town where this was happening. And they said, oh, you want to hear the other side of the story? Parents are sending their kids into town to live on the street so they can get decent meals every day.
Wow.
Now, it's not entirely an orphan situation, but you can see how it's that same kind of concept. You actually enhance the problem by setting up some big institution that's hugely well funded, and I could take you to some. We were talking about one of them in a city where we have a partner in Mozambique, and it's created all sorts of problems where they've shipped in orphans from all over the country,
I do recall as well in somewhere in Bright Hope World's history we were asked to visit an orphanage that had been funded several $1 million, only to turn up and find out it had never existed.
No, it was only a briefcase orphanage.
Yeah, boy. Yeah.
And of course, so just summarising that, generalising the whole thing, it is a Western concept and a breeding ground for abuse.
That's right.
And that's why in many places in the West where this is not a preferred kind of thing to be doing, no, either, for the same reasons we say it's not.
Yeah, and I think about our response here and, you know, alternatives that we've seen. We'll talk about some alternatives, but I think particularly around Chaba, where, you know, the response is the community recognises we have an orphan issue.
Mm.
Families that really couldn't afford to took in the orphans into a home environment where they were loved and cared for at an individual level. And then we work with those families to say, right, how do we build
how do we empower them,
local economy and
help
empower
them and flourish? Yeah, totally.
And so I suppose the short answer is we like to work at that sort of level. So rather than empowering an institution, we would rather work with families and say, look, how do we take in these
totally? Into and that's to us that's the answer to the orphan issue and the sponsorship issue.
Yeah.
And I mean, and to be fair, without being wanting to be critical of sponsorship per se, a lot of the organisations are doing that now. They're not just picking one kid there. They're actually working with families to empower. They're using the orphan as the touch point or the contact point for that family.
Yeah.
And where that's happening, it's great. But
we,
you know,
we're going to have to do it though. I mean, we're going to have to talk about sponsorship programs.
Yeah.
And you know, I am fearful of this because, you know, there are organizations that we have great relationships with that do this and do it really well and we love them and they're doing amazing work. But there are also organisations out there where something else is happening. So I suppose what we're doing both with orphanages and this is to say, know the questions to ask. Know the things. If you're engaging with this, here are the things to think about. Here are some of the unintended consequences. And so we don't do sponsorship programs, but why not?
There's a couple of things around this that I think you've really got to get your head around. One is, if you're going to get involved in supporting kids, then don't do it at an emotional level, so that you're just, you know, convinced by an appeal on the radio or on the TV or whatever. Think through, ask the right questions, because there are issues that you need to think about. Well, you know, what percentage of this money actually gets to the kid, for example? And we've seen, you know, that kind of thing where one kid out of a family is selected and others aren't, like with the orphanage thing. And the perhaps the saddest thing is that when sponsorship programs come along, often the parents give away their responsibility for those kids to the organisation, to look after their kids, to feed their kids, to educate their kids. And then there's a whole lot of corruption builds up around that. And so you get, you know, orphans, people brought into the orphan care program because he's the village chief. He's got plenty of money, but and he's got maybe three wives or four.
Yeah, I mean,
but his kids are orphans.
And that's a less obvious thing with the orphanage. One assumes orphans are orphans. Not necessarily the case at all.
No, and finding, how genuine are the orphans? And it's, I mean, from here, it's impossible to find that out, because all you get is a picture and you presume that it's been vetted, and it has been, but there'll be lots of stuff going on in there that you could never, ever go and sort out. No. We've been in places where you've had, like, rent a crowd, so unfortunately, you know, we recognise some of the orphans from the program in the next village from the day before. So the way they were orphans in two villages and getting sponsored by both, or they weren't orphans at all, they were just paid to turn up for the day. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm not accusing the international organisations of that necessarily, but what ends up happening is that's become the model for how do you care for orphans. And so you got lots of local NGOs or individuals that set up their own little orphan sponsorship programs. And we had a situation where we had a family who was pastor of a church way out in the back of Zambia in a little village called Kamatipa. And he had 27 kids that he was helping through school. And we were helping. A big organization comes through, signs up all these kids on another orphan care program. So these their photos were taken, profiles are written up, probably sent out to people in New Zealand or somewhere else, and but they never ever got any money.
Oh, that's helpful.
Yeah, very helpful.
It's weird, I guess, if we reflect upon that model and think why is the sponsorship model so popular? And you think, rather than, you know, as perhaps we've inadvertently been, you know, sort of criticising organisations. I look at it and I think that model is popular because of me. It's my fault, because what I want is a personal connection, and what I want is for my heartstrings to be plucked and to feel like I'm making a difference with that one person. Whereas in fact, you know, I think what we would say is, look, you know, get involved, partner, support the community.
Yep.
You know, it's locally administered and all that sort of thing. But really, all of that expense, all of that overhead, all of that cost is really to make
me feel good.
Feel good, isn't it? So I've got something to put on the fridge. And again, I'm so scared of saying that because I don't want to discourage people from doing it. But
no, and you hear great stories. You hear great stories about people's lives have been changed by it. And that's phenomenal. That's fantastic. But at the end of the day, an organisation or a program cannot intervene in the cycle of poverty.
No.
It's a person. Only a person can. And it's got to be the right person who can. And so when you come to talking about solutions, it has to be with key people who are motivated by love for Christ and love for these kids, not by how much am I going to get for looking after these kids.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I've said that before. And I think it's a great way to, a great lens to see these sort of things through, is poverty is only addressed individual to individual. So sort of think, what does that individual to individual connection look like on the ground? Is it a quality connection?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the closest, you know, the thing to support is, or the program to support is the one where that vulnerable child is being brought up in as close to a family environment as possible. I guess that's the thing you're looking for, and if that particular orphanage can do that, then that's fine. But as long as it's the right, but then you can't just assume that if it's right, it's great now, that it will be in 10 years from now.
Well, it's weird, you know. I think about the partners that we have in the sort of places where you see orphanages, and whether or not we're actually, you know, involved in work with orphans with a particular partnership. So many of our partners just have orphans with them anyway, because that is a common response, you know, for Christians in these places is, well, I'll take in orphans because they have need. It is thus always been in Christianity.
Yep.
And it's a great model for us to get behind those people that are doing it as a matter of course.
Yeah, I remember once we were in a country in Southern Africa, and it was during the period when HIV/AIDS was going ballistic, and you know, there were literally, you know, that whole childbearing generation had been wiped out. It was before there were ARVs to control the onset of HIV/AIDS and all the secondary diseases and complications that went with it. And we were in one church in one place, and the guy was, the pastor was saying from the front, you know, become a Christian, give your life to Jesus, and if you do, here's an orphan. It was like the expectation was that if you were part of this church family, you had a couple of orphans that you were caring for.
I tell you, that book I referred to earlier, which was talking about the children being put up on the Roman walls, it's called a book called The Way, Way Back, or The Way Back, or something like that. And in it, he said, if Christians want to retake, you know, their place in the Western world, you know, we need to make sure there is not one orphan or one unloved foster kid in the West. This is the pressing need. Yeah. And, you know, really, while we might be thinking about doing it in so many African and, you know, other countries that are struggling, that's exactly what they do, where they don't have the resources to do it, but they recognise it's fundamentally critical. It's God-led.
Yeah, totally. And so, yep, it's a big issue. Of course, when you put non-family members into other families, that can have negative issues as well. So there does have to be, if you're going to be going down this model, there does have to be, you know, quite a bit of training, mentoring, assessment going on. And because you go into places where you hear about extended family members or what, being abused, treated like slaves, in the family they're not treated as equals, and so there's stuff that can go wrong in this space as well. But it's by far a more sustainable model than setting up a big institution and then institutionalizing those kids, or making them dependent on external funds and resources and people. And
I suppose, you know, thinking about our response, I mean, I think broadly speaking, you know, empowering families, you know, finding opportunities for orphans and vulnerable children to be in a family environment, empowering those families so that they can do that, that's been a broad response. I think as well as the kids get older, you know, helping them with vocational training opportunities, and so they can go out and they can support the family at a time of life that's appropriate. Anything else in the mix that, you know, is perhaps a bit different, you know, where we're developing, you know, our thinking in the space, other ways of helping orphans and vulnerable children?
It's a tricky one, Fraser, because we are not in control of what happens out there. So, like, for example, we were just talking today about a couple that have been looking after a bunch of kids, and their marriage has come under such pressure that the marriage is kind of, they've split up. And so now the wife is left with a bunch of kids and she's caring for them without the husband there. So, you know, doing this kind of ministry is very stressful and difficult. There has to be, and I would say, a hugely strong gospel component to all this, because unless there's, in a sense, supernatural power and energy released into the care of vulnerable kids, you're going to get it wrong a lot. And so that has to be not just telling people words and shouting gospel messages at them. That's people living Christian values and lifestyles and exhibiting compassion and care and justice in terms of discipline and helping to shape people's lives and, you know, all that. So that's all that gospel stuff has to be flowing through here for it to work. But that has to apply if you're going to talk about orphanages and sponsorship programs as well. But it's much more difficult to pull off at that level.
Well, it just really does come down to the right people in the right place.
Right, the program and a place cannot deliver what's required to help these vulnerable kids get back on their feet, get some kind of normal lifestyle established and then flourish into the future. It has to be a key person. And so the one thing I would say from a Bright Hope point of view, when it comes to vulnerable kids, it's find the person who has that vision to step in and then come alongside their vision, their strategy to do that. And we're saying 9 times out of 10 it won't be an orphanage or a sponsorship program. It'll be someone creating family for those kids.
Quite right. Right, well, we are just about out of time. Thanks for being with us again on this session. It is a difficult one, and I think the takeaway message is family is important and getting it right is important.
Well, getting it wrong is it doesn't bear thinking about.
No, it does not. As usual, if you have any comments, thoughts, feedback, and for 2 episodes in a row now, we've said controversial things, so feel free to push back. You can do so, podcast@brighthopeworld.com, facebook.com/brighthopeworld. We'd love to get your feedback. We will be continuing this series. On the next time, we'll be talking about microenterprise and microloans, which is something we do a lot of. But for now, any final thoughts, Kev?
Yeah. I don't know if I said this in the last one, Fraser, but it bears thinking about. There's going to be about 1 billion kids born in Africa in the next 20 years.
Mm.
Okay. This is a seriously important issue for us to get right.
Yeah. And a lot of them are going to end up being vulnerable. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, that is us for today. You've been listening to It Ain't That Simple, Mate, the Bright Hope World podcast with me, Fraser Scott, and Kevin Honoré. Thanks for joining us, and we will be back with you again very soon.